It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. What happens when a utility company loses a major industrial customer due to a plant closing or facility shutdown? Other ratepayers might have to pick up the slack. A Superior, Wisconsin utility company wants to raise its rates for electricity, water, and gas due in part to the projected loss of income following the Husky Energy disaster in April. Some residents are pushing back, saying rates are already high. We talked to a WPR news reporter about the back and forth on this potential increase, and we'll also get the latest on a new program that offers treatment rather than a jail sentence for drug-related offenses. Superior residents, let us know, how do you feel about this proposed rate increase? And what concerns you here? What do you have? What questions do you have? Or does this make sense given changes that are needed and what has happened with Husky? Tell us more about what you think that way, too. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Daniel Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior and host of the regional program Hear Me Out. Danny, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
So first of all, let's talk about what's behind this rate increase request from Superior Water, Light, and Power.
Yeah, they're requesting this rate increase for a number of reasons. One that they say is the most important is because they're making major improvements to upgrade their system. They've been repairing a lot of water mains and lines in the city, and they're also doing work at their water treatment plant, and they're repairing an electric grid or electric station in the city. And so that's one reason that they're saying that this is important, that they need to raise rates right now. Another part of that is the fact that Husky Energy saw a series of fires back in April, and they are Superior Water, Light, and Power's largest water utility customer. They use 25% of the 843 million gallons of water that were sold last year. So they're looking to raise electric and natural gas rates by about 2%, and then they would raise water rates by about 8%.
Some local residents have suggested that since Superior Water, Light, and Power buys its electricity and natural gas from other suppliers, they could just buy less and skip the rate increase.
Yeah, they can buy less, and they will save money, so it's not like other municipal utilities that would be under stress if a large utility customer were to go out of service like that. But they're saying that because of these improvements that they're making, I think they spent around $18 million this year in capital improvement projects, that they need to increase their rates in order to pay for those projects.
So let's talk about the water side for just a second, because 8% increase, that sounds like a lot of money. But Water, Light, and Power is saying, well, look, we've put off a lot of improvements to the infrastructure, why do they need to do them right now?
Well, they need to do them right now, they say, because they've been putting it off for so long, and they can't do that anymore. So they're saying that, you know, we've tried to keep costs down for years, and we just can't afford to do that anymore in order to keep people drinking safe, reliable, clean water. So that's why they're doing it now. You know, one of the reasons that Superior's water utility, where their rates are higher than most water utilities across the state, is because it's a privately owned water utility. And the Public Service Commission considers the rate of return. They set that a little bit higher so that they can make payments to shareholders. So that's one reason why utility customers in Superior are seeing a little bit more expensive monthly water utility bills than elsewhere in the state. I think Superior pays, according to Superior Water, Light, and Power's Paul Hope, Superior pays $50 per month on average for their water utility bill. And that's for 3,000 gallons of water used. You compare that to Eau Claire or Madison for 4,000 gallons of water a month used, and that's around $20 a month. So they're paying much higher than other larger cities in the state.
Local residents are quite understandably not happy with this. They had a chance to weigh in during a public hearing recently. Tell us about how local residents are feeling.
Well, they cited a number of reasons why they're not happy about this rate increase. One being that Superior Water, Light, and Power already increased their water rates last year by more than 9%. They did decrease natural gas rates, but residents are upset that they're having to shoulder yet another increase, and they feel that Husky is partially to blame for that. They also perceive a lack of efficiency in the way that Superior Water, Light, and Power is doing their operations. And Superior Water, Light, and Power is saying that one reason, Superior customers may be seeing a higher monthly water bill, for example, is because there's a fire protection fee that's included in their utility bill, and that sets it a little bit higher for some rural communities in the state.
So public protection, a fire protection fee, explain what that is.
So there's a fee that's included on the utility bill that goes, it's like a property tax fee that goes to pay for the cost of fire protection in cities. That never used to be a part of the utility bill. That used to be a separate fee that was assessed by cities. But it has since become included in that to provide the cost of, responding to fire calls.
Responding by the local fire department or by Water,
yes.
Light, and Power?
Yes.
Okay.
By the local fire department.
Okay. All right. So did the has the request had any support from community members?
Has it had any support? If there is support for the project, it wasn't voiced at the hearing. There have been more than 160 comments that have been filed online as part of this rate request. I know that Enbridge, another large utility customer here in Superior, is asking to decrease their rates because they want to see that come more in line with the cost of service because they feel they're paying more right now than it costs Superior Water, Light, and Power to serve them.
And of course, if their rates go down, then the rest of the ratepayers have to pick up the slack.
Yeah, according to the Wisconsin Citizens Utility Board, residential ratepayers could see their rates increase by 6% if the commission approved a decrease for Enbridge.
So, speaking of Husky, what's known about when they'll return to normal operations?
Well, Husky is saying that they're trying to come back online as soon as possible, but they don't expect that to happen until 2020. So that there's going to be a while yet before they come back online and start using a lot of water here from the water utility. And the Superior Water, Light, and Power is trying to account for that in this rate increase, where they've been having conversations with the commission over how to make an adjustment if Husky were to come back online sooner and sales would increase. They're looking at possibly setting some funds aside for a refund for ratepayers, but that's all undetermined yet because the commission has not yet made a final decision.
Yeah, I was going to ask if when Husky comes back online, are the rates going to go down? But we wouldn't have any guarantees on that.
Well, they're looking to account for that right now, the Public Service Commission is. So, it's undetermined at this point what will happen.
All right. Okay, well, I know you'll be following this story very closely, and we'll get updates as necessary. Danielle Kading, WPR News reporter based in Superior, stays with us as the morning show continues on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Wisconsin Department of Justice is experimenting with a new program that would offer drug offenders treatment instead of jail time. Do you support this idea? Treatment rather than a jail sentence for drug-related offenses? Why or why not? Maybe you've faced a drug-related offense. What was your experience? Would treatment have been your preferred experience during that process? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. WPR news reporter from Superior, Danielle Kading, stays with us as our guest in this segment. Danny, tell us about this statewide pilot program offering a choice between jail or rehab. How will this work?
So basically, there are three law enforcement agencies that are taking part in this. That would be the Superior Police Department, Door County Sheriff's Office, and the Sauk Prairie Police Department. And anytime a person that might be arrested for a nonviolent offense, but it's drug-related, they could refer them, instead of booking them into jail, they could refer them to treatment. Or if they come into contact with someone on a welfare check and they note that, you know, they're dealing with an addiction, they could offer to get this person help. And it's all aimed at reducing recidivism.
So who would be the offense must be nonviolent. Who else is that the only criteria for eligibility? What else?
Well, yeah, the offense would have to be nonviolent. So, you know, if someone were to commit a crime when they were high on drugs and they were hurting someone, that would obviously probably not be a candidate to take part in this pilot program. Usually it's the people who are committing property crimes, like they're stealing or shoplifting to support their habit. Those are the type of people that agencies come in contact with that would be able to take advantage of treatment rather than being put in jail because of their drug use.
Is there a sense of how many people these three communities might hope to serve?
I don't think so at this time. I think, you know, it's fairly new. I think they're hoping that they'll serve a lot of people so that they can keep them from using other taxpayer dollars, you know, as far as the amount of overcrowding that they see in the jails here. That's been an issue in Superior and elsewhere in northern Wisconsin. I know that it will be available to residents of Douglas County, even though it's the Superior Police Department that received the grant, and it will be the same in Sauk County, even though the Sauk Prairie Police Department received that grant. They're hoping to reach as many people as they can with the limited dollars that they receive.
So how is this being funded, and what does the funding cover?
So they received a $261,000 grant from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and that funding would cover the costs of administering the program, and it may also help fund treatment services for people they come in contact with, as long as dollars are available. You know, they might use that grant money to send people, you know, get them a taxi cab to the treatment center or something like that. So that's what the money would be used for.
We're talking with WPR news reporter in Superior, Danielle Kading, and we want to hear from you. Have you faced a drug-related offense? What was your experience? Would treatment have been your preferred option during that process? What do you think? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So if someone in this program successfully completes it, what happens then? Do they still get charged for the offense?
No. If they successfully complete treatment, they won't be charged for the original offense. But if they don't meet their obligations under treatment, they could be charged with that offense. So it's all contingent on whether or not people actually follow through and are able to make it through the treatment services.
So who's tasked with managing the treatment?
So in Superior, the Superior Police Department is contracting with the Lake Superior Community Health Center, and they'll be providing things like medication-assisted treatment in a case where it might be an opioid addiction. Because, of course, there is no medication-assisted treatment available for people who have a meth addiction. It might also provide primary care and therapy. And they would talk to them and do case management and look at, you know, all the reasons why people might be addicted to drugs, you know, and housing and food insecurity play a role sometimes, and whether or not a person has the ability to stay sober. So they would be looking at all of those things to try and encourage people to kick the habit.
Now, the grant here is coming from the State Justice Department. Is this kind of a change in direction for the Justice Department? Traditionally, we've kind of just said, okay, if you've got drugs, you're going to jail. And do you have any idea of why they would support this pilot program?
Well, I don't think they would say that. The Wisconsin Department of Justice, through Attorney General Brad Schimmel, says that they've been working on treatment and diversion programs for the last 3 years, and that they've been doing that through increased training and staffing and data collection to try and look at places where this might be successful. And they've done a number of treatment and diversion programs across the state and put grant money towards that. I think it's becoming more common now, as we've seen that you can't arrest your way out of this problem. People realize that if you're going to try and keep people out of jail and reduce the cost to taxpayers that way, that you've got to help people up front and give them some services to keep them from reoffending once they're out of jail.
So this is a pilot program. It's being done in three areas in the state of Wisconsin. How long is this program expected to run? And let's go with that question first, and then I have a follow up.
Okay, I believe it's a 2-year program, so it would run through, I think, the end of 2019. It was supposed to start, It's a 2-year program.
So at the end of the 2 years, then, how will we know if the program has been successful?
That's a good question. I think that they're going to be monitoring it along the way to see whether or not people are remaining clean. And if they're helping people and keeping them out of jail, I think that will be the measure of whether or not this program works.
And let's say that it does work. Does it sound like if the program is evaluated and said, yeah, this works, that it could be expanded then to other communities or even statewide?
I think that is the hope. But, you know, one of the barriers for programs like this is that there are not a lot of treatment providers, especially in rural areas. A lot of the people I talk to in law enforcement who treat people who have addiction say we need more treatment centers across the state to deal with this crisis, especially with opioids. We need more treatment centers to be able to really make inroads on helping people with their addiction.
Let's take a quick call from Jim, who's joining us from Watertown. Jim, we're almost out of time here, so I'll ask you to be brief, please.
Sure. Okay, if the rehab centers that you're making here take the time to get the proper information to give to the kids to allow them to understand why they're getting sick, then yes, it's a good program. If not, it's just a training camp to get worse. I've been through rehabs. The only one I ever found that told me what was wrong with my head when I was sick was out of North Carolina. It's a state-run facility. Please get that information to these people so they can get better when they're ready. It won't cure you at going to a rehab center, but if you have the right information, it builds upon you getting better later.
All right, Jim, thanks for that. And Danny, we need more treatment centers. You've pointed out that people are saying this if we want to expand this program. Jim is saying, okay, not only do we need more treatment centers, they need to be giving the right message. I don't know how you would respond to that, but take a shot at it anyway.
Well, I think, you know, he has a point in that people have to be ready to treat their addiction. You know, if they're not in that place yet, if you put them in treatment, they won't be successful. So, you know, it's a difficult thing to treat. It's a problem that's going to keep happening until people are ready, whether it's the services that are provided or the person themselves, to meet that need.
Well, I know that you've been following the Wisconsin's drug issues for many years, and that you'll continue to follow this story. What are you looking for next as this pilot program continues?
I guess we'll just be following it to see how things work out and be checking in to see what progress is being made and if people are staying in treatment or ending up in jail.
All right. Danny, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, John.
Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior and host of the regional program Hear Me Out. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The CDC estimates that 80,000 people died from the flu or complications related to the flu last year. That's more deaths than we saw from vehicle accidents, gun violence, and opioid overdoses. And this year, we might see that total climb because so many people do not get vaccinations. The question is, why don't more people get vaccinated? If you haven't had your flu shot yet, why? If you're on the fence, what's holding you back? Or maybe you're someone who knows that getting the flu shot is a good idea, but you still haven't done it. Well, why are you putting it off? People who have had the flu shot, did you previously avoid getting the shots? Maybe you changed your mind. What happened to change your thinking? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Dr. Conway is also a pediatric infectious disease specialist. Welcome back to The Morning Show, Dr. Conway.
Thanks for having me. Good morning, John.
So 80,000 Americans died from the flu last season, according to the CDC, more than the number of people killed in car crashes. But some people still aren't getting their shots. What's going on here?
Yeah, it was a remarkable year, probably the most attributable deaths in about 40 years. And, you know, I think part of the problem with flu is it's just so unpredictable. And I think people do slide through certain years that are milder seasons without the vaccine. And we get caught then when a number of them have not been vaccinated and we get a particularly bad strain or series of strains that come circulating through the community.
So what exactly is the flu shot? What's inside this thing?
Sure. So the idea of vaccines is to essentially fool the immune system into thinking it's already seen a disease before and already has developed its own protection from that. And there's a couple of different versions of flu vaccines around. Obviously, the injectable ones are the ones that have the longest track record. And there's a number of different potencies for different ages and different ways that those are given to try to stimulate the immune system. And then there's also the nasal flu vaccine called FluMist, which is a live activated attenuated virus, which basically is a mild version of actual flu that can be given as an intranasal spray.
So that sounds like the way that we originally vaccinated people for smallpox was we gave them a case, but a mild one, and they survived that, and then they were immune.
You are correct. And so this was kind of going back to something that might be more stimulatory to the immune system because people were a little disappointed that sometimes the injectable vaccine doesn't seem to give people as much protection as we would like.
So what are some of the most common misconceptions that people have about the flu vaccine?
I think the most common one that we hear is that people feel like they can actually get the flu from getting the flu vaccine. You know, I think that there is certainly at the injection site some discomfort, and then, you know, a fair number of people will have a little bit of achiness as their immune system does get turned on. And I think people will then extrapolate and think that they've actually got a case of the flu, or they'll be in a setting where they'll be getting the vaccine and they'll pick up some other respiratory virus and put two and two together and think the two are associated.
Yeah, I got my flu shot, but I also got my pneumonia shot on the same day. So I had two sore arms and it was a little achy for a little bit the next day, but a few ibuprofen later and I was right as rain. We asked people on Facebook why they didn't get the flu shot, and Camille wrote us to say that the one time she got the shot, she got sick. So it's not uncommon for people to say this. Why do you think this is?
Well, the problem with the flu vaccine season, when we're giving vaccine in October and November, also happens to coincide with the uptick in respiratory viruses in general that happened throughout the United States during kind of the fall and early winter. And so I think it's fairly common that people are going to start coming down with viral illnesses. And unfortunately, at some point, some of those are going to coincide with when they got their vaccines.
Well, the flu shot isn't the cure for the common cold. The common cold and the flu are often confused. Why is that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different respiratory viruses that circulate, and we do talk about influenza-like illnesses being caused by a lot of these viruses. The flu virus in particular, though, is much more severe than the rest of these respiratory viruses. People, you know, generally have pretty severe headache, lots of muscle aches, and fairly high fever, as opposed to the other types of viral respiratory illnesses that in adults, at least, rarely give them much fever. And, you know, it's mostly runny nose and cough. So influenza, you know, the reason it kills people is that it then does lead to those secondary pneumonias in a fair number of people that are you know, unfortunately going to do them in sometimes.
Well, and NPR had a story recently about a man who his flu symptoms were so severe he went into organ failure. They had to put him in a medically induced coma for about 10 days, and he was actually in the hospital for 58 days. So some of these, sometimes the flu can have absolutely devastating consequences, and yet people still don't want to get the shot.
Yeah, his story was particularly interesting and concerning because he was a great example of an otherwise normal, healthy person who didn't really think that they're at much risk and got particularly ill and fortunately survived.
It seems like the flu has gotten worse in recent years, or maybe we're just hearing more about it, but this argues that the flu shot is even more important now than it actually than it used to be. Is this really true, or do we just perceive that the flu has gotten worse?
No, I think over the last 10 years, I think we've had a couple of particularly serious seasons. You know, when we see influenza, it's usually jumping from animal species or recombining an animal species. And so when people talk about bird flu and swine flu and things like that, that's genuinely the source of the virus, is that they jump from those species then into the human side. And then there's a lot of recombination and genetic mutations that happen in those viruses as they move around. And so we have had the emergence of some really interesting strains over the last 10 years.
Let's go to the phones. Danny is with us in Racine this morning. Danny, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the thing I always heard was that they have to decide what flu strain to do the year before because of the time it takes to actually make the vaccination. And I know plenty of people that weigh the idea that, oh, it might not even be the correct flu versus feeling crappy for a few days or, you know, just going through the whole rigmarole of getting a shot.
Yeah,
Dr.
really.
Conway?
Really interesting question, Danny, and you're actually onto something very interesting. So, you're right. What happens is, you know, during our summer, which is the winter down in the southern hemisphere, there's a lot of surveillance that goes on around looking at which viruses are circulating there, and then, you know, over now 50 years or so of experience, the CDC and the WHO can use that to model and predict what are the viruses going to look like then as they start to circulate here. But he's right that they have to make a good guesstimate by January or February to be able to have enough vaccine available in October when we need it here. And so what they've ended up doing is putting multiple strains into the vaccine. So I think people may see when they're out getting their vaccines, the discussion of trivalent versus quadrivalent. What that means is that they used to put three different strains in the vaccine, two types of A and then one type of B, and decided that since they weren't always that good at guessing on the B strains, we now get four strains in most of the vaccines, two different A strains and two different B strains.
So how often do public health officials miss the right strain and get it wrong?
Well, I'd say that about 50% of the time, the strain that ends up circulating is not identical to what's in the vaccines, but usually they're pretty close to at least getting in the ballpark. And this is one of the reasons that when we talk about how well does flu vaccine work, The idea is to give you just enough immunity to hopefully prevent you from getting severe disease. It may not prevent complete disease because these viruses are constantly changing, but at least if we can prevent people from having serious complications, we would consider that a win.
On Facebook, Tom commented that he's never had a flu shot because he's never had the flu. Maybe it's just a coincidence. He doesn't know, but that's his reason. Dr. Conway, is this another reason people don't get the shot? They just don't feel a sense of urgency because it hasn't affected them yet?
Yeah, I think there are people that, you know, if you're particularly careful about hand washing and staying away from sick people and those kinds of things, I mean, you can certainly minimize your risk of flu. And, you know, there are a fair number of people that, you know, especially when they're relatively healthy, are able to fight off flu on their own. And certainly some people have had mild flu and actually have some immunity. But it is in some ways gambling when you're saying that I've gotten through it the past couple of years. This is actually a good time to then flip the coin and actually say I'm going to stop gambling and actually protect myself.
Well, and we're talking about herd immunity here. Talk about that a little bit in terms of vaccination theory.
Well, the problem with our communities is that not every person can get vaccinated. There are certainly people that have allergies to the vaccines or have some medical contraindication or may not even get full response. And the idea of herd immunity is that if enough people in the community are protected, that even if somebody enters the community, and people are getting off planes every day with influenza and entering the country, but if somebody enters that community with influenza, the idea is that there's a firewall of other people that are protected already that then help protect those people that may not be immunized or may not be able to be immunized. So herd immunity is really the idea of community immunity, having enough people in the community protected so that the virus just can't get hold and start to circulate.
So good hygiene, hand washing, that kind of thing, is that a substitute for getting a flu shot then?
I wouldn't say it's a substitute. I'd say it's an augmentation. You know, we know that the vaccines aren't perfect, but they're pretty good. And if you can add in hand washing and hygiene stuff, again, aren't perfect, but are certainly good. The combination of those things then, I think, does lead to ultimate protection for most people.
We know that nearly 400 people died in Wisconsin from the flu or related illnesses last year. Just over 7,500 people were hospitalized. Some people hear that and still will probably choose not to get the shot. What's the research say about why people believe what they do when it comes to the flu shot?
Well, I mean, as you know, people have mentioned, as one of your Facebook posts mentioned, you know, a lot of people just don't get the flu if they are in situations and are careful. And so they then get this false sense of security that they're really not at risk. Similarly, people, you know, that get the vaccine and feel like they've got some illness afterwards start to attribute those two things and tie them together. And so I think that combination of false sense of security along with fear of the vaccine puts some people then in a position where they make decisions to leave themselves at risk.
We're going to continue our conversation about the flu vaccine. Why haven't you gotten your shot yet if you haven't gotten it? 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway stays with us as our conversation continues. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about the flu shot. The flu season is here, but many people haven't been vaccinated yet. If you haven't gotten the shot yet, why not? What questions do you have about the vaccine? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. James Conway is with us this morning. He is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is also a pediatric infectious disease specialist. We know, Dr. Conway, that the very young and the elderly are the most vulnerable to the flu, and I just want to share a little story with you. Someone I know of got an email from a sister who was announcing the imminent birth of a child and said, if you want to come and visit the baby, make sure you've had your flu shot and your pertussis vaccine, because otherwise don't show up. So this person taking the flu very, very seriously. Why is it that the very young and the elderly are the most vulnerable to the flu?
Well, first of all, that's a brilliant proactive health activity that person was trying to get people to participate in. You know, we're actually very concerned about young infants and the elderly, mostly because their immune systems are just not up to snuff and don't respond and pivot quickly when confronted with new things, which is part of the reason that, you know, infants and the elderly need so many vaccines to keep themselves protected. You know, we're actually so concerned about newborns that there's now much more attention towards trying to immunize pregnant women and giving pregnant women a flu vaccine and a dose of the Tdap vaccine so that they can actually transfer some of that immunity to the baby to start off the first couple months, at least, until the babies then can start to get immunized themselves. So babies in particular, especially because they're held and passed around and are around so many other people, are really quite vulnerable to these kinds of diseases.
So we had a caller who couldn't stay on with us, Brad from Eau Claire, who wanted to know about the use of mercury as a preservative in the vaccine. Is mercury still a part of the vaccination, or has that been eliminated?
No, so thimerosal was a preservative that's been around since the 1920s, and it's a form of inert mercury. But because of people's concerns about these kinds of things back in the late 90s, the manufacturers started to remove those kinds of preservatives from the vaccines. There's a few of the vaccines that it's used up some part of the manufacturing, but it's all removed by the time it's actually ready to be put into people. So currently there's no vaccines that are using that kind of preservative anymore.
Last year's flu season was pretty tough. We've cited the statistics already. Do we have any idea what this year's flu season will look like?
Yeah, it's always a really hard process of figuring out exactly what things are going to look like. You know, at this point, I think the groups that I'm in contact with are estimating that we're probably looking at another moderate and potentially severe season, depending on what the viral mutations look like. There's already flu that's showed up in Wisconsin, you know, as early as September. There's already been some flu deaths in the United States already reported. So it's already shaping up to be a relatively early season, and some of these viruses that are circulating do look like they're somewhat severe.
Now, last year, only 36% of Wisconsinites got the flu shot. How many people are health officials hoping for this year?
Well, we always hope for 100%, but that's unrealistic, especially because the manufacturers only make enough vaccine that about half the country could get it, even if everybody did want it. So I'd say that we're always trying to maximize flu vaccine delivery into the young, into the high-risk populations, both the elderly and those with immune problems, as well as pregnant women. But really, you know, this is a vaccine that everybody should avail themselves to.
Other than having doctors talk about this issue on public radio talk shows, what else could we do to raise awareness?
Well, I think it's important for people to talk about it in their communities and in their churches and schools, and telling people that they got vaccinated. I think one of the most powerful things people do as a society is share with each other what they're doing. And when people do get vaccinated, I think they're making a statement that they should try to encourage others to follow along.
Maybe we should have a sticker that people can put on, like the one you get when you go vote, the one that says, "I voted." Maybe we could have a sticker that people could wear that says, "I got vaccinated."
That's a pretty clever idea, John. Actually, I may look into that.
Yeah, well, you don't even have to give me credit. let's take a call from Christine in who's joining us from Hudson. Christine, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm calling about the 80,000 people that have supposedly died from the flu last year, and I would really like to make a clarification for the listeners. According to the CDC, that number includes people who died from pneumonia, flu-like symptoms, and undiagnosed flu. According to the American Lung Association, that number of people that died in the United States from diagnosed flu was less than 5,000.
Dr. Conway?
So it's kind of an interesting, you're kind of mixing apples and oranges, but I appreciate your concern. So it's really hard to get a firm number, which is why, you know, 80,000 is such a round number. Obviously, people would question that. And, you know, it really is admittedly something that is done on an estimate basis. There's a lot of, you know, particularly sophisticated modeling that goes into these things. But it's an estimate, and it's based on extrapolating from what types of diagnoses people die from and then how many of them actually even got tested for influenza. So unfortunately, influenza testing is underutilized, and there's a lot of people that can get very severely ill and never get tested. You know, we are in this mode in medicine in the United States now where we're trying to minimize unnecessary testing and keep costs down. And so unfortunately, there are quite a few people we find that only after the fact do we realize they actually had influenza. And so the use of these other constellations or combinations of symptoms to describe an influenza-like illness is sometimes the best we can do. But it's an imperfect science, especially because a lot of people just never get seen with their illnesses.
Is there an ideal time to get the flu shot?
I mean, I think that, you know, as soon as it's available and early, it takes, about a week or two after you get the vaccine to have your immune system fully up to speed. And so, I'd say October is ideal because we certainly know that then when November, December, January hit, when people are traveling and a lot of these things start moving around the country, that's when we really start to see an uptick across the entire country.
And is it ever too late in the season to get one?
No, it isn't. And that's one of the things that's really interesting is that we usually do see kind of a late season March, April blip of usually a late arrival, often of B strain. And so even if people don't get vaccinated until January, February, there actually is still some protection that they will get from those late season strains.
Now, if people were to take anything away from this particular segment, it's that they should go get the flu shot if they haven't already. But is there anyone who shouldn't get the flu shot?
Well, I mean, people with immune system issues should not get the nasal flu vaccine. That's really restricted for kids and healthy adults 2 to 49 years of age. But other than that, if you've got some kind of actual allergy to the vaccine that you've been told about in the past, should you really hesitate? You know, we used to be worried about people that had egg allergies because a lot of the vaccines are actually produced in eggs. But it turns out that over the last couple of years, we've realized with more intense study that even people with egg allergies can actually just get the regular flu vaccines. There's such a small amount of egg protein in those that's really not even much of a risk. So really, these are vaccines that are available and should be utilized by everybody.
But where can people get more information about when and where to get their flu shot?
Well, the CDC runs a particularly good group of websites that have a lot of information. There's another organization called the Immunization Action Coalition, or immunize.org is their website. Both of those have really very robust information. And then obviously the Wisconsin DHS website, the state immunization program, has a lot of information available as well.
And by the way, Randy from River Falls called in and said that he got the shot last week and he did get a sticker. So they're doing that in River Falls. So dang,
nice.
I was already behind the curve, late with another idea. Oh, well.
Drat.
Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Pediatric Infectious Disease Specialist. Thank you for joining us again this morning, Dr. Conway.
Thanks, John. Have a good day.
You too. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.